Hello, everybody, and thank you for that kind of open door, which is actually open for years for me. I've been, you know, joining Sangha Live quite a few years. The difficulties haven't got less, though, in these years, and they're, if anything, increasing. We are an island. It's good to remember Sangha is an island in a crazy situation in a sea of, I would say, unwisdom, blindness, and lack of compassion that we are experiencing intensely in this part of the world. But it's not just this part of the world. And this evening, I don't really want to relate specifically to what's happening here in this part of the world, although, you know, I will with a few stories, but I want to see if I can kind of offer some teachings that come out of being what does Dharma like in a war zone when the rockets are falling, and what does Dharma, how does Dharma can help, if Dharma can help us when the rockets are falling, and much of the cannons are going the other direction, makes no difference. We're in a global situation of conflict and insecurity and divisiveness and polarization and confusion and loss of values. And so it's really about all of us here. It's not just about my experience in this part of the world. So if I can offer something that helps all of us, that's the direction for this evening. So I want to share a small story. In 2 years that I've been in the north of Israel, we live 12 kilometers away from the Lebanese border in a kind of alternative lifestyle village. And there's been nearly two years of rockets coming from Lebanon and the artillery coming from all around us in the opposite direction. And death and destruction over there. The pain is, as I say, on both sides. Generally, I've had Dharma ways to keep very steady and compassionate. But one day it just, I felt really triggered by all the bangs. There's 10 bangs and booms on average every day for 2 years. At a certain point, I felt quite triggered. And my wise granddaughter came to me and said, "You're a Buddhist. Don't forget, every bang, treat it like the stick of a Zen master." So, a beautiful comment from a wise granddaughter. But I think that that's the direction I want to take. When the things are breaking down, when there is fear, when there is insecurity, when we don't know what our children, grandchildren are going to, how they're going to live, we have to see it as a wake-up call. Because it's a fundamental samsaric truth that we're meeting full on instead of kind of covering it over with a relatively comfortable life. So it's like a disease, but a disease in the body of the community. So I would like to relate to what's happening in the conflicts and so on as a kind of wake-up call, and where can it take us and how we can wake up to another look at reality and not get drowned by the problems and the conflicts and the insecurity. So I want to start with our meditation. And the meditation will emphasize qualities and capacities that are built in to the practice of mindfulness. And we often think of mindfulness, awareness, presence, connection to what arises in our experience as itself a technique that helps our life, but it's not clear sometimes that it can also actually specifically activate powers and capacities within us. And one of them, which the Buddha was talking about quite a bit, is trust and steadiness, which we all need at this time. And the Buddha said, just one piece that I think is so important. He said, to be an island in the stormy seas, you have to actually see a deeper truth, such a dharma, the truth of dharma, in the moment, in our experience, as opposed to the building of story, constructions, issues, mental patterns, etc. The truth of the moment is very simple. This breath, this body, the wind on our cheeks, right now, all of us together in the sense of Sangha, you're listening, I'm speaking. There's a truth in the right now. And if we connect with that truth of right now, it gives us a place to stand. It gives us a ground on which to stand. And that's basically that quote from the Buddha. So I just want to say that mindfulness can help us develop powers and capacities, including steadiness, which is perhaps a simpler word for equanimity, but right at the beginning. And so let's practice that now together. And then I'm going to give a talk and we can have after that some dialogue. Okay. So as the invitation in the chat, you can sit comfortably. And that means really letting go of stresses and strains that we've collected in our body during the day and during the week and during the month and during this life. Just kind of soften everything, but feel that we are sitting steady and very alive. And really just drop in to the aliveness that we feel right now without looking for any specific object of attention. Just a general open sense of aliveness, total presence. I'm here and I know it. And it starts our practice without looking for something or without trying to meditate or without a sense of a right way of doing things. It's much more open, just allowing, coming home to the sense of being here, alive and present and aware in this moment. And this is our home. In the simplest language, taking refuge in the Buddha is simply coming home to being aware and present right now. Aliveness. And there may be sounds. And there is the steady ground under our feet that is supporting us under our legs or feet. We feel the weight of the body on the ground. And surrender. The earth supports us and gives us a message of steadiness, of being held by something bigger than us. And connecting with our inner world. And the inner world and the outer world actually one. We were receiving the outer world. Now let's receive the inner world. Our breathing. The bodiness of the body. And at this moment, we can allow the breathing also to be a kind of a teacher or a metaphor of the natural flow and change. Of the flow of life. Of an invitation to let go. And just receive the waves of the breathing, of the air and the oxygen giving us life, coming from the world. Again, let the breathing carry us. Soft, easy. Maybe the rising and falling of the tummy. And if we relate to the breathing the connection to the breathing, the knowing of each breath, it does carry us into a place of presence, of quietness, and of belonging. We are here. We are at home. With natural breathing happening. It's as if the breathing is inviting us to feel steady and present and very alive. If there's thinking, this too is part of our home. It's the mind doing what it knows, just like the breathing is doing what it knows. We don't need to feel that it's disturbing or problematic. Let the thoughts just pass by like the waves of the breath. It's important to see thought as natural and part of the life energy and not a problem that stops us. I really like the Tibetan image that our thoughts are like children of consciousness that are playing, playful. But we go back to the body. Let's explore touch, the hands touching, the pressure of the body on the seat or on the floor, the lips touching, what's happening, what are the hands saying to each other? What are the fingers saying to each other? Can we listen to them? We can get a sense that as we listen and get close to the life of the body, just like the life of the world around, the earth, the sounds, there is a fundamental relationship of allowing, of listening, of trusting. We develop trust. We trust the experiences of the body. We trust this breath. We trust this mind to do what it needs to do. We trust the earth. It's a movement of the heart. A movement that says, I care for this body, I care for this life. Buddhist language, appamatta. It's awareness with caring, with a sense of connection. If there's a place in the body mind that feels a bit disturbing or uncomfortable, we can allow that. It's part of the reality, it's part of our experience. And as we go to it and explore it, for example, attention. It can be anywhere in the body. Even very light, such as around the eyes, because we use them all day. We get a sense that as we move our attention to a place that's a little bit uncomfortable, it's a gift. We bring, in a way, we bring kindness, we bring caring by getting close to the place and exploring what it's telling us. There is trust in that, as opposed to distance, shutting down. Exploring places that are comfortable, places that are uncomfortable, something that is disturbing us, or something that is not disturbing us, that is calming. Just being very allowing, allowing the experience to be what it is and getting close, listening. Get it going right there. We're listening to what the body is telling us. We're listening to what the mind is telling us. But we have an open door. We are available. We are ready to receive our experience just as it is. This is the truth of this moment. We allow these visitors to come in through the door. We meet them as they come in. And that empowers us. And so we'll just take one more minute to be quietly embracing our experience, especially at the level of the body, and a sense of okayness. This moment is what it is. Okay, we'll take a deep breath and let go, and slowly, slowly you can open the eyes. Okay, so I'd like to give a talk about the subject for this evening, which is a little humor. And don't forget, the Buddha himself has had a lot of ironic humor. And so I'm just joining with the Sangha. But the title is Samsara Fixable? And you probably know the word samsara. It's just basically the wheel of life, the conditioned life that gives that we're born into, the body that wants to survive, and everything that goes with it. So I want to start with a story. One day, some months ago, when there was still a lot of, as I say, rockets coming over. So one early evening, I was standing outside with a friend, watching the sunset from my house. And it was a kind of a huge sky, which was red. It wasn't spectacular, but it was just a huge sky of red color. And all of a sudden, two rockets, actually interceptors, flew up between me and the sunset, or between us and the sunset, leaving a trail of smoke and then bursting with a bang. And clearly there were somewhere in the Haifa area or whatever, the interceptors between the sunset and myself. And both of us, my friend and myself, had this reaction that the sky couldn't care less. The rockets couldn't damage the sky. It was just an image which was so clear. And it may be a radical view because there's so much pain inside the rockets. They symbolize pain, destruction, blindness, hard-heartedness, lack of caring, lack of, you know, all the whole story. You know it all. But we do need to pay attention to the big picture here. We do need to ask, so we have a choice to be entirely submerged in the human tragedy, or also to step back. So, of course, we have to be engaged with the human tragedy. There's no way we can be in an idealistic world, a kind of abstract world. Of course, the Buddha wasn't there, and you know, great figures like Dalai Lama. We are entirely engaged with the human, the humanness, the human suffering. But at the same time, we have to ask, so is there a role for, the, if you like, the ocean point of view, or do we just get washed and knocked over by the waves? So what's the ocean point of view? How does that help us? I think we need the wave point of view, and we need to, of course, because we're born in a body and we're human and we feel suffering of others, and we have to engage with that. There's no question. But we can also pay attention to universals here. And it's somewhere very deep inside the spiritual discourse, if you like, a dialogue between a form and emptiness, emptiness being the more universal. I remember a girl in a sangha here said, I feel so open when I meditate and practice spiritually. I feel I belong to the trees and the olive trees, and I walk, and all of a sudden, something reminds me of a bang or of a artillery in the hills around, and I feel so small and afraid. And how do I hold the two together? I think it's a question for all of us, because it doesn't really matter whether we're here or in London or Austria or maybe Hawaii. There's one of you, a message from Hawaii. Maybe Hawaii, we can forget it. But actually, the truth is, no, not even nowhere. We're one planet. We're one community. We can't pretend that it's somewhere else. So on the human level, there is much work that we can do. And I'm not going to go into this too much because I've already given talks, actually also on Sangha Live, really about this aspect. What can we do to develop the capacities to be with the impossibility of conflict, insecurity, danger, threat, and things collapsing that we are used to call values, human values, kindness? So there's a lot we can do. And I'm just going to go through it briefly because I want to go to the more universal aspect after that. And that's more of this talk. But just briefly, some reminders. The first thing is, don't forget, we all need first aid. When things get difficult, we do need to be very clear that we need help. What is it? What kind of conditions feed kusala, which would be wholesomeness? And we can't all do it on our own. We need sangha. We need reminders of kindness. We need especially to be careful about how our attention is hijacked. We need to be careful about toxic, the volume of toxic inputs into the consciousness. So we need to be careful of what's coming in. And we need to allow what's coming in to remind us. That's, I would say, first aid. It's helping others. It's going into nature. When the rockets were falling all over here, what helped me was every day I would go in the garden and I'd grow my vegetables and I was there digging the earth and feeding my chickens. And when young families went away because it was scary with children, so I would go around and feed the animals, the people that went off abroad from here. So that's the first aid. We have to remember it, a lot of attention to what's coming in, and can we be careful about our attention getting hijacked into unhelpful inputs, the volume of unhelpful inputs. Secondly, we do need a lot of practice of awareness, and that means allowing things to be the way they are, allowing our fear, allowing our despair. But also, the moment we allow our feelings to be authentic, we also allow our joy. We don't say, oh, I'm not allowed to be happy. I'm hearing quite a lot. I'm not allowed to be happy. Things are so bad. We are allowed to be happy. We can be joyful because we can be honest with what's arising in this human heart and be honest. Allow what's arising to be there. So that's a practice of awareness. It's like witnessing, to be a fair witness. And it's instead of all kinds of constructions. And I would say most of the violence in the world is constructions built on fear. Instead of experiencing the fear and looking at it and allowing it and then it passes, you build out of it story. We have to fight them. They're the enemy, etc. We have to protect. I have to protect my children. That means, you know, endless. It's no end to it. And it's the story. It's not the fear itself. So a lot of that awareness practice we really do need to do. And we can experience coming back home to ourselves. And when we do that, we realize we are big people. When we meet ourselves fully, we see we're big people. We're not small people afraid. And it's important to kind of remember that. And we meet ourselves fully, with all our capacities, with our powers and our kindness and our love and our sympathy and our compassion. We all have it. So, and then one more thing that I mentioned already, meditation does help us actually develop capacities, not just experience the truth of this moment, just as we did in the meditation just now. Once we are kind of surrendering and allowing ourselves to be close to what, even if it's painful, in that movement there is trust, saying, I am ready to be with this experience. I'm not shutting it down. I'm not covering it over. I'm not running away from it. I'm not pretending it doesn't exist. I'm not in denial. I am ready to meet. That needs trust. It's as if when we get up in the morning and we go out in the street, we need a certain trust to say, yes, okay, I'm ready for this day. It may not be pleasant. We may have unpleasant experiences, but this sense of being ready and allowing things to be the way they are, and I am ready to meet what arises in this day as we go out in the street. What Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, to call things by their true name. So all of that is ways which we can feel more steady with in the middle of difficulty, conflict, arguments, and so on. The Buddha said, by the way, if you get into deep conflict and shouting match, you can say, if you're trying to argue with someone that has very strong views and is very emotional and very angry, forget it. Don't bother. But don't forget the power of equanimity, of steadiness, which is a power. And it's one thing that we can do to help ourselves and others not to forget what it's like to be steady in the middle of difficulty. It's a powerful message. Although it's quiet, but it has an effect on the world. But anyway, I want to go into a little bit into the samsaric, the big picture. The first thing is we really feel it's beyond me. I don't really know what you mean, Stephen, when you say the big picture. I can understand that. But the thing is that the big picture already helps us. For example, when we go to nature and we walk in the forest or we walk in the park or we sit under a tree, the sense, where is the sense of well-being? It comes from belonging because we are there with nature. We are nature sitting with nature. That sense of belonging is the big picture. It's us and nature being together as one. Even a little bit, it's what makes us feel good in nature without any concept. Our caring heart, the care that we feel, we love goodness at everyone's heart. It's called otapa in the tradition. We all have a heart that loves goodness. That's already the big picture. It's manifest in many, many different ways. Caring. We care for others because in a way we are them. I know it's not so easy when we look at pictures of what's going on these days. And it's too much. But on the other hand, but we feel the pain of others because we are them. We are with them. And that's our big heart, a heart of compassion. And of course, we feel limits. We feel limit to our compassion because we can't really, we feel I can be compassionate. So far, I can't be compassionate to, I don't know what, Netanyahu. I can be compassionate to them, but not them. We can always feel limits. We do feel limits because we're human beings. And we feel pressure to fix things and pressure to undo things and pressure to struggle against difficulty and pain and despair. And these things are our humanness and there are our limits. But even that, we need to kind of see there our human mind, the pressure to fix things, to control things is itself painful. I'm reminded of the biblical book of Job. It's a very difficult book. and it's an amazing book. It's a great Dharma book, the book of Job, because pages after pages of pages with amazing metaphors and descriptions, Job suffered in an unexpected way. It just landed on him, immense suffering. And he just couldn't understand why. And he all the time wanted an answer. Why am I suffering? I'm a good person. All my life I've been giving. I'm ethical. I've been giving to others. Why do I suffer? What's going on? What's the reason? And all the people around him, the community, tried to give him explanations. And he wasn't satisfied. He said, no, it's not good enough, these explanations, that you in your previous life were like this, or because you some things you did you didn't know, etc., etc. He said, no, I don't accept any of that. These are explanations from the mind, and they don't feel right. And in the end, by persistent, he said, I only want to hear God, if you like, that ultimate voice telling me why I'm suffering. And in the end, he did, by persistence, is like a really good meditator and didn't stop. Persistence. He actually heard the voice of God in this book. And it's really interesting because God didn't say anything about suffering and didn't give any explanation. And what happened was nothing to do with the human mind whatsoever. The voice of God was a poetic, revealing nature of things, the truth of things. Just look at the deer. Just look at the whales in the sea. Just look at the sky and the sunset. Just look at nature that you don't understand and you didn't do it. And it's just let go into what is. And that is the answer. There isn't any other answer. And when he got that, which is beyond the mind and beyond human interest and beyond control and beyond explanation, when he got that, which is, as I say, beyond the mind, everything worked, sorted out. So we have illusion that if we fabricate enough, if we construct explanations, if we can fix, if we have, we can control things, it will be, we can fix things. It's the end of the mess. And one very obvious place to think about this is a view of karma. And we can start there, actually, because karma is a huge issue, but it's certainly some test of how we look at things beyond us called fate. And it doesn't allow us to have any small explanation. It doesn't, karma isn't, doesn't fit any rational, logical explanations at all. The Bhagavad Gita is perhaps the best example of this, where Arjuna said, how, just like today, how can I fight a war against my family? What happened? I can't do it. And he threw down his weapons and sort of collapsed. And Krishna, the voice of the beyond, said, shut up. Stop being so full of yourself, basically. Karma is not in your hands. You didn't produce this. You can't say it should be other than that. It's very, very painful to you, but you can't say it should be other than that. So the Buddha took karma, took this to a much more subtle place. The Buddha, huge wisdom there. He said, you cannot be dualistic about karma and fate. Because if you, on the one hand, say it's fate, it's what's happened, we just have to put up with it, it leads to nihilism, it leads to determinism. But if you say, I'm in control, it leads to an absurd hubris and chaos. And neither of them are helpful. What's helpful is a deep understanding that of what Paticca Samuppada, the dynamic nature of this moment. This moment is the result of millions of conditions, and you really have to allow that to be the basis of your actions in life. And there's a beautiful Tibetan story like this about two guys hanging out in the market, and one got hit by a stick, and he started to shout at the stick. And his friend said, you're crazy, you're shouting at a stick. And his friend, and he said, oh, yes, yes, that isn't very clever. So he started to shout at that arm that holds the stick. And his friend said, why are you shouting at an arm? Shout at the man whose arm it is. It's not the arm's fault. So his friend said, oh, yes, you're right, you're right. Started to shout at the man. And his friend said, wait a minute, you're shouting at the man, but you don't know what made the man hit you with a stick. It can be he had a hard time. It may be he hasn't had breakfast. Maybe you don't know anything. So you have to shout at the conditions that made the man hit you with a stick. And his friend said, yes, you're right. And he started to shout at the conditions. And he said, wait a minute, the conditions of the whole universe, how can I shout at everything? And that's the point. I think we have to allow that this moment, right now, it's 8 o'clock. It's your time. All of us together, We're listening to each other. We have a presence. This moment, it takes the whole universe to make this moment what it is. We can't say we know how this moment is constructed. Yes, we can say, I put my finger on the button of the computer. Sure. But a million things that create this moment and this finger and this intention and Sangha Live and everything else. And so understanding that everything is free and dynamic, and it gives us hope because we are part, our intention is part of the conditions. It means nothing is lost. Because every word we say goes out into the world and changes something. Nothing is lost. The universe is just a web of interacting causes and conditions that make this moment what it is. I had a very personal, you could say tragic, but also very, very moving experience. A few months ago, an old friend of mine, who was really a kind of a pratyeka Buddha, you call it, like a kind of a solitary Buddha living in the village here, 82 years old. And I've been even one of my closest friends for 30, 40 years. And one day he came running into the class that I was teaching and said, I've discovered something really amazing by watching the fire. I see that the fire told me that everything in the world is constantly changing its shape. There's nothing that is fixed. The whole universe, the whole of life is just a shape-changing dynamic, changing shape. And that the dramatic thing, 4 days after he said that, there was a fire in his house that burnt his house and burnt him as well, and he died from the fire. And it was really shocking. 4 days after that, it's as if the fire changed his shape as well. He was actually before that very ready to die himself. And he said, even before that experience, if I die, I'll just be changing my shape. It just goes back to where it came from, my body. So he was a wise, dear friend of mine, but it was a dramatic story. And it reminds us that everything is changing its shape and we need to kind of adjust to that. And it helps us to face an incredibly difficult situation, such as what's happening now in Gaza, with eyes that are a little bit bigger, that we're not in charge of the situation, we're not in control. And it does help us to go to compassion rather than to despair and anger and the need to control things. And instead of that, it takes us somewhere else because we see that nothing is lost. So I can go out into my life and I'll help in one thing or another without measuring what's better, what will help the people in Gaza, what will not. I will do my best to manifest my good heart and help suffering wherever I can. Wherever we can. I would say, our heart says, be available wherever we can offer ourselves to the world. But it's this big sense that that's what I can do rather than a sense that I have to fix this. I know it's so painful to look at situations such as in Gaza, but if we look at it as being, we're not in control of this, like the book of Job. So what is it that can help us have that, develop that kind of really open, compassionate and heartful way of living? It's a way of life. And the Buddha said that it's yoniso manasikaram. Basically, it's a more feminine quality of awareness. It's a caring awareness, which is what we're doing in the meditation. It's a wise heart. It's not an analytic mind. It's not measuring. It's a heartful. It's in the word citta, which you probably know, bodhicitta, or citta is mind, heart, in the Pali. So it's the heart is in it. And Yonesi Manisikaram is a more kind of a soft, caring awareness. It's awareness that connects us. It's an awareness that spreads out into the world. It's awareness, an awareness that's effective in the world, because it's like a mothering awareness. And the Buddha said that's how, or at least the tradition says, that the Buddha reached awakening because of using, or because of development of Yonesa Manisikaram, which is not kind of a masculine analytic wisdom, but more of a caring wisdom. So it does go with quite a lot of letting go. If you like, the view of the ocean says, the waves are painful, but I don't have a view of the way things should be. I don't have a view that things should be like that. I don't measure that things should be like that. You can't get freedom. You can't get happiness. You can just allow freedom and happiness. You can allow the, it's not something you can grab and grasp and obtain and measure. So all of that is a little bit beyond a kind of ordinary conceptual mind. And in a way, caring for ourselves and the other, and caring for people we don't even know, and being effective in the world asks us to be beyond the ordinary mind of measuring and controlling and trying to fix. But it will just happen by itself. Our caring heart will go out in the world and will make change. We develop our caring heart, and we then just donate it. If you like, done. We just develop our caring heart and we donate it to the world as dana. That's all we can do. But you can see somewhere that if we take the big picture, it helps us to do that constantly without burnout. Well, I'm gone to demonstrations. So many people in here. There's such a strong voice, by the way, against all of this madness here and against the violence and against the cruelty. But people are exhausted. They go to demonstrations. They've been going years, even before the current war, and not much changes. And I think you can kind of get to see that we're not alone in that. You go on the streets of London and you try and kind of demonstrate against all the kind of hardness in the world, and not much changes. But we have to keep going from that place of donating, what developing our qualities of caring and a big compassionate heart, and donating it out there. And it's not struggling against life. It's being right in life. And it's not making a theory that life is a problem. Life is not a problem. Life is life. It's actually perfect. It's perfect with us or without us. We were talking about it before. Life is life. But it really helps us to see more carefully what are the seeds that we sow? What is the kind of waves that we make in the world? So, a final sentence. I love this quote from the Tibetan teacher, Padmasambhava, who said, keep your vision as wide as the sky, but sieve your actions, sieve, like in a sieve, sieve your actions like sieving fine flour. And it's kind of a beautiful quote, because what I'm talking about, samsara, is not fixable. It's painful to a human person and to other beings and sentient beings that want to survive. It's not fixable. The Buddha said it's been like that for thousands and thousands of, from the beginning of time, samsara has been like that. And from the beginning of time, nirvana has been like that. It's not something that came yesterday. And so from that place, we can't struggle against it. We can just act from the biggest place that we can. And we keep our vision as wide as the sky, and then go out in the street and do what we can, small actions that make karmic waves in the world. We can cry, of course, when we feel the pain of ourselves and others. We can laugh when we feel the joy, because it's still there. We allow both, and we develop the powers that we can of Dharma, of a deeper truth of things. One small little story, again, not about me, but it's been very important in the peace work that we've been doing for years with Palestinians and Israelis out here. There was a priest in America in the Vietnam War who was sitting outside the Pentagon every night with a candle. He's called A.K. Must. And it's such a beautiful story. It's influencing me until today. So he sits in a vigil all night outside the Pentagon. And people come to him and say, "Are you crazy? You're sitting here all night. You think one person, you, with a candle, can change the whole of the Pentagon, the whole of the industrial military complex of America? You think you can change them like that?" He said, no, you don't understand. I'm not sitting here with a candle so that I can change them. I'm sitting here all night with a candle so they don't change me." So, yeah, I'll be happy to have any questions, thoughts, comments. Welcome. Yeah, Charles. Go ahead.
Hi. It's late morning here, where I am in Las Vegas, Nevada. I really appreciate, number one, your gracious generosity in doing this. You seem like a wonderful person. And I don't think any of us would be here if we didn't agree with what you say and your approach to life in general. Where I am having great difficulty, and I have been for a long time now, and I've never received from someone who is of your dharmic state of mind what I feel is a satisfactory answer. And that is, where do you draw the line between your Pacific ideals and ideations and dealing with an immediate existential threat? So if you were in the kibbutz where the October 7 invasion occurred, and you're there with all of your very wonderful, justified dharmic ideals and intentions, what would you have done if you were there with your family?
Well, I can tell you very simply, because actually I haven't been, I was 2 years under rockets here in the North. Do my best to protect life. Do my best to protect life. And I have no idea what that would mean. So don't ask me to make a plan, because I don't think it's everything I've learned until this moment, all the practice and the meditations and the readings and everything that I've learned that is in this being here will be challenged at that moment to make a spontaneous response. So I would do my best to protect life, my children's life, so I try and run away. I might, if someone's coming with a machine gun at my door and was, and it happened spontaneously, I could defend the people. I might do it. I don't say that I wouldn't. I mustn't. But I don't know. I don't know. I can't tell you any strategy. It everything that we are at that moment is challenged to make to respond, and what that would be. I hope I would find a way to undo the situation with no violence. That's all I can say. Just like in Aikido and Japanese, that's the Japanese Buddhist, by the way. A lot of martial arts are built on that. to try and defend yourself without hurting the attacker. So hopefully I'll find a way to do that. But again, karma, I have no idea.
Stephen, I don't, and may I call you Stephen?
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. I am. This is not in any way a political or discussion of any kind. This is a macro sense discussion, but it's very respectful. I really respect you. But when you say you have no plan, someone has to have a plan. So is that fair to leave it to others to plan to protect you and then demonstrate against others who are fulfilling their plan that they feel is justified? When you say, I have no plan, I'm just going to respond when it happens. Well, you must have a plan if you have a rifle to respond with, or if you learn martial arts to respond with, and I'm a martial artist. And it's not always just Aikido. Believe me, they did dispatch people with regularity. To me, I really would love it to be exactly like you would love it to be. But the real world and my respectful mind says, if you do that, you're a dead duck. You've got to learn to protect you and yours and others. And so
it could be, and it could be, I prefer to die. I have no idea what the, I have no idea. I can't tell you. I don't have a plan in a situation like that because it's totally spontaneous. I hope that, you know, satyagraha, the power of truth, says Mahatma Gandhi. Nonviolence is, there's a truth in that. I hope that it would carry me through a difficult situation, but I have no guarantee. I have no plan. I'm sorry. I am planned by other, I am planned by the big picture. That's all I can say.
A really wonderful man. I wish you had a plan. Okay.
Okay, Charles, thanks a lot. Yeah. So, anybody else? Colette, hi.
How are you? I totally relate to no plan. My son and his wife, I've been married for many years, and I trusted that they weren't going to have children because of the state of the world. And I was quite content with that. In January, they told me they were expecting a child, and I was just blindsided. And I said congratulations, but privately for 2 months after, I cried in despair and grief because I thought, poor baby. Well, the baby was born, and I had no plan how to react, but you know what? I knew I had to come with care and love and compassion for everyone. That was the only thing. I couldn't have told you beforehand how I would react. But like, I hear you, like in the moment is when you do what you think is best. So it's sometimes we can't predict how we're going to react. But if we come from a place of care and a big heart at the moment, I think we can trust that we'll be our best selves. I absolutely appreciate your talk, Stephen. Thank you so much. I hope you and your family are safe. Thanks.
Thank you, Colette. I just want to add there two small points. One is that you had a belief, Colette, that the belief and the view is we shouldn't bring children to this world in the way it is right now. That's a view. Mm-hmm. And it's totally legitimate to have views, but it's beautiful to let them go. And to be aware, as you are, of having a view and letting it go at the same time. So a great deal, you know, this discussion of plan, I think is fine, but actually flexibility, the ability to dance with change and unexpected, including violent, potential violence, and including love, and including everything in between. The flexibility is a very, very basic quality that is defined in as part of the wisdom mind that the Dharma is developing. The Dharma is non-attachment, merely dancing with change. So anybody, Hi. Bartek. Hi. I don't hear you. You're getting cut off.
No, that it's my end
Maybe you shut your video. Maybe that would help. I don't know.
I don't know about okay.
This thing.
Are you using Bluetooth earphones? Maybe if you take them off, just
yes. Okay, let's try. Hello. Can you hear me now?
Not really.
My question.
Okay. So, Sam, and meanwhile, we'll have a look at the chat in a moment for Bartek's question. But Sam, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for your presence and the stories and that talk that really moved me. And I don't have the words to express quietly how it made me feel good, but it did. So thank you very much. And you spoke about a concept. I actually typed my question in the chat just to be sure that I understood the name of the concept, something with feminine wisdom or care. And I just wanted to make sure I had that right so I can further my researches. It was something like Yoniso Manasika. Is that it?
Manasikara.
Yeah, Manasikara. Okay, cool. Thank you. And do you have maybe something to say about it? And is there like a word for the opposite of that concept? Am I making sense?
Yeah. It's I'm not sure the opposite of that concept. But Yoniso Manasikara is, it's like the watchfulness and the carefulness that you need in order that your awareness practice, your practice of being clear about what arises, doesn't become a kind of blind, I mean, awareness, but not caring, a neutral sort of awareness, a technical awareness to be very, very aware, but you can do damage because you're not paying. It's like a mother knows to cook and to look after a baby. And what kind of awareness is that? That's a more feminine awareness because the mother knows what the baby is going through. By awareness, even if the baby can't talk, and the mother will know what's the problem. And it's that kind of sense of awareness with a certain caring, careful attention to what's needed. So it's translated sometimes in Old English as heedfulness. You'll look it up when there's many sources. And what's the opposite would be a more technical sense of a mindfulness practice being technical or being mechanical, and just a mind is like having a really sharp, strong mind that can take things to pieces, but it doesn't, it's not holistic as holistic. So perhaps that would be the opposite.
So is Yoni Manasikara the same thing as compassion, or there's another word in Pali for it? Okay, so what's the difference with those two?
Well, compassion is very clearly a sense of the totality of you and the world belonging. You and the world are one. And so you feel it's a heart, an unlimited heart, immeasurable. It's one of the four immeasurables, Brahma Viharas. It's something if you like, sacred and immeasurable. Your heart is part of the world and therefore caring for everything. So it's a much more universal sense of being with and belonging to everything. So your Nisa Manasikarma is much more of a practice. And it will lead you to compassion, and it will lead you to awareness, and it will lead you to liberation. But compassion is, if you like, the fruit of Nisa Manasikarma and other things, other practices as well. So compassion is like the fruit. It's the way, it's the ocean, if you like.
Okay, I see. So one is like the tool to get to a certain state of being, kind of?
Yes, yes.
Okay, I see. Yeah. Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Maybe we'll look at Bartek's question quickly if he's there in the chat, because I don't, maybe you can pick it out.
Yes, it. Bartek wrote, "Hi, Stephen, sorry about my technical issues. How are you connecting with compassion when it's challenging like rockets in your situation? Can you please say something about that? Thank you."
I think it's really, it's also a little bit relates to what Giles pointed out. Compassion isn't a personal point of view. It's not about safety. If I'm busy with my safety and every rocket comes over, I have to run into the shelter and think how to do it and get worried and alarmed and so on. I'm busy. The mind is taken up. It doesn't have space. So instead of that, compassion would be, I feel compassionate to the people that are sending the rockets because they know, they think that that's going to help them in some way, and it's illusion. I'm compassionate to the people under the rockets, including myself. The rockets are falling on us. I'm compassionate to the ignorance that says, this way we'll find safety and happiness. This is the way that we'll be happy and safe. And all these illusory things that just invites compassion. So the compassion is in a way beyond the busyness of personal safety and protection, but it includes yourself. It's not that you put yourself outside and say, you know, kill me, but you're just one element of a much, much bigger sense of, you know, the Dalai Lama was compassionate to the Chinese that killed and tortured so many Tibetans. And he said, the one thing I have that's left that I will, that they cannot take away from me is the compassion, including compassion to them. So it kind of, it's exactly what this talk is about, the big picture that touches the heart and is inclusive, and you feel it's beyond my own personal interest and safety. But I think it is actually a move towards safety, that compassion is actually helping everyone to be safe. So we're already coming to the end. Do we have time for one more question? It's on the half hour, so maybe there's anyone else would like a quick one? Or maybe you want to read something from the chat, because there's loads of questions there, but I didn't have time to read any.
Mostly appreciations.
All right. Okay, so thank you very much, everybody. And it is... it's very appropriate to end this meeting with the sense of compassion and the sense that we are belonging to with a web of life, if you like. It really is bigger than us. And we can see that touch our hearts. And when we feel for others, we see in the media a picture of suffering people, never mind the Palestinians or Israelis or the Sudanese or the Ukrainians. There's so much. It's what touches our heart is because our compassion is so well built into us already. And all we just have to keep with that, keep it bigger and bigger and bigger, the compassion broader and broader and more inclusive. And I would like to finish with that, because that's something we all can do, and it's needed in this world. Great. So thank you, everybody. You can see there's more stuff in my book and more stuff in my website and et cetera, et cetera. And be in touch.